Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and we'll be talking today about caviar. My guest is Michelle Nyhaus, who writes about science and the environment for National Geographic and other publications. She is also a contributing writer for Smithsonian and a longtime contributing editor of High Country News, a magazine known for its in-depth coverage of environmental issues in the American West. Her most recent piece is Caviar's Last Stand. She published it simultaneously with FERN, which is the Food and Environmental Reporting Network, which I have been promoting since their inception. I had their editor-in-chief, Sam Fromarts, on when they launched the site, and I have continued to read it avidly and support whatever in whatever way I can by inviting their authors on. They always have great articles. This one is no exception. The media partner for this particular piece was Medium.com, and it is about the loss of a species, basically in the service of gluttony, whether for money or for food. It all boils down to greed, and we have basically fished out every possible source of caviar. So, Michelle, welcome to the show. Tell us about why you wrote this piece and what got you interested. Michelle?
Well, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can now.
Okay. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, sure.
As you said, I write about environmental issues, and I'm always interested in ways of bringing environmental issues home to people's front yards or plates, in this case. And I found out about this story in a way that I almost never find out about stories, and that was through a boring old press release from the Fish and Wildlife Service, which said, hey, you know, these we have issued indictments for these eight people who have been involved with paddlefish poaching for caviar. And I'd heard of caviar poaching, but I assumed that most of it took place around the Caspian Sea in Eastern Europe. And the idea of caviar poaching in the Midwest was very surprising to me, and I wanted to learn more about it.
Yeah, very surprising. I mean, it's hardly what you... I mean, you're talking about Missouri, like the Ozarks, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, you're talking about a community that you don't think of as even really eating caviar, much less knowing enough to, you know, poach the fish in order to sell it on the black market abroad. I mean, the whole thing just, like, I couldn't get over how funny it was, actually, on a certain level. I mean, of course, it's horrible that these fish are being abused this way. But it was also very kind of like so Ripley's Believe It or Not to me. I mean, it was just a crazy story.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and it's a real cultural collision. I mean, a lot of the poaching these days is being done by Russian and Ukrainian immigrants who grew up eating caviar on special occasions and really, you know, have a strong emotional connection to it.
Right.
And have also, you know, and most of those, a lot of those people are fishing for this so-called American caviar perfectly legally, but there's a small minority of people who are poaching it for money, and they know how valuable it is because it's valuable to them. It's emotionally valuable to them, and they know how financially valuable it is.
Well, let's talk about the numbers. What kind of money are we talking about here? I mean, you had some pretty astonishing figures there.
Yeah, well, I should back up a little bit and say that the caviar we're talking about is caviar in quotes. It's caviar that comes from paddlefish, which are a relative of sturgeon, which is the family of fish that supply the world with, you know, the very fancy caviar we know. And paddlefish are also, like sturgeon, big, rare, slow-growing fish that produce a lot of eggs. And the eggs can be processed in the same way that sturgeon caviar is processed. And they don't taste quite as good to gourmets as sturgeon from sturgeon roe, as they call it, from Eastern Europe. But it tastes good enough to fool people, especially people who don't eat caviar that often.
Right.
And so people have figured out that you can label paddlefish caviar as Russian caviar and sell it in New York City or sell it to airlines or cruise lines, and people really don't know the difference. So it's not that paddlefish you can buy paddlefish caviar legitimately, not a very high price, but you can sell it labeled as Russian caviar for anywhere between $250 to $500 an ounce.
Yeah.
That adds up pretty quickly when a single paddlefish can produce 10 pounds of eggs.
Right. Yeah, I was blown away by the numbers. So then, you know, just one fish is worth, you know, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 to some lucky
exactly.
Go ahead.
It's small, it's lightweight, it can be very easily smuggled. So, you know, in some ways it's the ideal black market item.
It is indeed. I mean, really, and especially now that pot has been legalized in so many countries.
Yeah. And it, I mean, the trade in, there's a you know, certainly a legitimate trade in genuine caviar as well as paddlefish caviar. And I've seen estimates that that's about $300 million worldwide. But the illegitimate trade in caviar of all sorts is thought to be more than double that.
So. Wow. Well, and you, and we'll go to this in a minute, but you describe one guy who's been doing this for quite a while who finally was run to earth in Panama or something, and it was estimated. What was his take on the black market? It was something absolutely astonishing. 10 million
at least. And that was just what he was charged with. I mean, he'd been doing it for a long time, and and he was also a legitimate caviar importer, and he was just, you know, cooking the books and fixing the labels and making a lot of money on the side by buying this paddlefish caviar much more cheaply and then marking it up as Russian caviar.
Right.
So
and
it
would
was
you
a good
also...
day for him for a long time, and he was on the lam for, I think, more than 20 years.
Yeah.
He was finally, you know, taken into court and sentenced just a few years ago.
Well, I mean, people have got to read this story just to believe it because it's so much fun. But let's talk a little bit about how is caviar produced. I mean, you were talking about like some really kind of low rent methods, like putting the putting the eggs through a paint screen into a bucket and then salting them or something. I don't really know anything about how caviar is made traditionally.
Yeah, so caviar basically, so they're fish eggs that are treated in salt water, and there's a very precise process of when you catch the fish. You catch the fish just before the female sturgeon is ready to spawn, and supposedly that's when they have a certain texture that's very pleasing to the mouth, and then you carefully screen them through, you know, just gently rub them over a screen to remove all the membrane and matter, and then you treat them in salt water, you cure them, and that's when, if you catch them at the right time and you handle them very carefully and you preserve them very carefully, that's when you get this incredible gourmet experience that chefs talk about, where you just have this wonderful combination of fat and salt that's exploding in your mouth and providing this taste that really is like no other. So these guys who I talked to, a game warden who had gone undercover and posed as a caviar smuggler, and he processed caviar the way that these guys in Missouri were processing it, which was basically, you know, the same principles, but it's much less methodical and much less careful. You know, they were taking screens off of screen doors and kind of pushing the eggs through the screens into a 5-gallon bucket, and you know, they came up with a product. A lot of them knew what they were doing, and you know, came up with a product that was certainly good enough to pass muster with customers who weren't experts. So they must have been doing something right, but it was a pretty jerry-rigged setup they had. It certainly wasn't done in any kind of, you know, super sanitary kitchen.
Well, yeah, I mean, that crossed my mind. The whole food safety issue of it definitely resonated with me. And but then I was also wondering, the Russian caviar, if I am not mistaken, is no longer imported. I mean, they don't even have sturgeon left in the Caspian Sea, which I think is where it originated from, right? I mean, tell us a little bit about the European market and what's happened there and why these paddlefish have become so popular in terms of smuggling.
Yeah, and that's really the heart of the story and, and the reason why I, as an environmental journalist, was drawn to it. We have been chasing sturgeon across the planet for probably thousands of years. Caviar has not always been a delicacy, but it's always been recognized as a food and as a nutritious food.
Right.
And the problem is that these fish are so large. You know, the largest ones can weigh up to a ton.
Wow.
More than a ton. They are so slow growing that these are like old growth trees. You know, once you cut them down, it takes decades, if not centuries, for them to be replaced in the population. So if people get really wild about sturgeon in a certain place, it's very easy for them to fish out the population to cause a local extinction within just a few years. So we've seen that story repeated over and over again. Started in Russia when caviar first got popular in Europe, thanks to Catherine the Great serving it in her court. It got popular with upper-class Europeans in the 1600s, and that's when we first started fishing out the Caspian Sea. Then the trade switched to the U.S., and we fished out our sturgeon populations on the Atlantic coast, and then it switched back to the Caspian Sea. And now the Caspian Sea is really devoid for all intents and purposes, there are not many sturgeon left in the Caspian Sea. And so the reason why this trade has become, has shown up in the Ozarks is that there really is nowhere left. There are, you know, there's some sturgeon out there for sure, but as far as making a reasonable commercial trade in caviar, there are not many places left on the planet where you can do that. So,
right.
So this is the end game.
Amazing. I mean, they do. I think you mentioned in the article they can be up to 100 years old, and it probably takes them 50 years to reach sexual maturity, which is true with some other species of fish. The orange ruffy, for example, lives to be about 70 or 80 years old and does not start producing young until it's middle-aged, from our point of view, you know, like 35 or 40. And that's why that fish has just plummeted in terms of, so it's the same deal. Isn't sturgeon a river fish? I think of it as more of a river fish than a... It's not a freshwater, or they spawn in freshwater?
They can be freshwater, or they can be both fresh and saltwater, like salmon.
Right, because your players in the Ozarks, those are in the river.
Yeah, so
and
these
dragging.
Are freshwater. These paddlefish are freshwater, but in the Caspian Sea, they live, you know, they spend different life stages in saltwater and freshwater.
Right. So now, let's go back to the people in your story, because they were very funny and colorful. The DeVries brothers, Spanky, I think, was, or Sparky. And then the
Spanky.
Guy who's under...
I unfortunately didn't get to meet Spanky.
Oh, what a shame.
But I wished I had.
Yeah.
And he was part of a family of good old boys from Tennessee, basically, who were fishermen and realized, I think it's thought that this caviar dealer, Gabardino, tipped them off to the fact that, hey, they were making a decent living selling fish, but they could make a lot more money smuggling paddlefish caviar to him.
Right.
And so Spanky and the rest of his family got into the caviar smuggling business, and this was in the late 80s, early 90s, and they were busted in an undercover, after a lot of undercover work,
It was very cloak and dagger.
Sometimes frightening undercover work by the state game wardens.
Yeah,
so,
I love that
so
story.
Those were Tennessee guys, and then this latest round of indictments is they are all Russian and Ukrainian immigrants who, like I said, they have a cultural connection to caviar, and they've gotten into the business perhaps through that.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so I just found it fascinating that they found themselves in Warsaw, Missouri, on the Osage River. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that where those guys were operating? And how big give us a sense of what that town is like. How big is that town? I mean, it can't be a very large urban center,
it's
right?
Tiny, a couple thousand people.
And so nobody knew this was going on?
I'm sorry?
Nobody knew that this was happening, that they had this, like, smuggling business going on, or they just turned a blind eye to it, or what?
Well, people did, and I spent a lot of time with the game warden there, who wasn't involved in the undercover work because everybody knew him, but right. he had been there for 30 years, so he's seen all of this unfold, and he said, you know, people who lived there did know, some of them knew a lot more than others, but people suspected that something was going on because dead paddlefish started turning up everywhere, and yeah. that town makes its living on legitimate sport fishing for paddlefish. That's a big old funny scene in itself, where guys come from all over, mostly guys come from all over, and fish for these enormous fish. And so they, when people saw these paddlefish turning up dead on the sides of the lake with their bellies slit open and the eggs taken, they thought, something weird is going on here. Legitimate fishermen wouldn't do this. What's happening? And so that's when the local game warden started hearing about it, and when right. they called in state and federal undercover agents to figure out what was going on.
Well, are the sport fishermen eating the paddlefish as well? I mean, you were a little dubious, it sounded to me, in the article about whether or not this is good eating.
It's well, they say it tastes a little bit like pork.
Okay.
It's kind of a firm white meat. It's not, the paddle fishing scene is it seems like, and people say it's mostly about having fun. People do, they don't want to waste the meat. They will take it home and eat it. But they are really, they're not out there solely because they think it tastes great.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a premium dish. You can find all sorts of crazy paddlefish recipes on the internet, though. And interestingly, people who fish, who sport fish for paddlefish, rarely keep the eggs to eat them. You know, they think they're kind of slimy and disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
So what other people are cherishing as a delicacy, the guys with the fishing licenses who are taking home the paddlefish are often just slitting the paddlefish open and throwing the eggs back into the water.
Oh, my God.
Yeah,
now, so, why is it that people want to catch paddlefish? I mean, they must weigh hundreds of pounds. You just said that a sturgeon could go up to a ton. They're 7 or 10 feet long. I mean, I saw the picture on the article. I mean, they're big. So if you're not going to eat the
huge.
Eggs and you're not really loving the meat, like, why can't you just catch and release? Why don't they do that?
Well, they have to catch them in this. These are things that, as a journalist, you never expect that you're going to learn, but then you do. The way to catch paddlefish is that they're filter feeders, so they don't like regular bait. They don't, you know, they don't go for a worm or a fly.
Right.
That you basically catch them by chance by dragging a big hook and a heavy rod along the bottom of the river and hoping it will encounter a paddlefish. So once you've done that, releasing them is pretty difficult. And people just, and they are the craziest looking fish you've ever seen. They have this long snout, you know, it's about a third as long as its body.
Yeah.
And they're just huge. And so I think in a way they're a trophy. People enjoy showing them off, you know, showing them off to their friends that they caught this huge fish. And the paddlefish guides I talk to just say, it's like it's like gambling. People just love the adrenaline rush that they get when they do snag a paddlefish and get to drag this monster up to the, you know, floor
right.
of their boat and show it off to everyone.
But then is there a booming business in taxidermy? So are people stuffing and mounting their paddlefish?
I don't know. I have seen some mounted paddlefish for sure. I don't know how booming that business is, but it's there.
Yeah, so. Right? I mean, you got to do something in Warsaw, Missouri. Listen,
yep.
Michelle, we're going to take a 1-minute break here for a sponsor drop, and we'll be right back to talk more about caviar and the caviar trade. Stay tuned, folks, and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
When your mind is breaking you. Hey, my name is Betsy Andrews, executive editor of Savera Magazine, and I am hanging out at the coolest, most delicious place in the world, heritageradionetwork.org.
Rock and roll. I haven't heard that drop before. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. My name is Katie Kiefer, and I'm talking with Michelle Niehaus, who is an environmental reporter who just put together a really interesting and wonderful article about caviar's last stand. It's about paddlefish caviar smuggling, cloak and dagger material, and all published with Medium.com in partnership with the Food and Environmental Reporting Network, something which I, a publication which I strongly urge everyone to support. They also have a great daily thing called The Ag Insider that's written by a guy named Chuck Abbott, which I read religiously, and that comes on your into your email box every day if you're interested in American agriculture. It's always a good read. Anyway, so let's go back to our caviar trade, Michelle, and tell us a little bit about, because you mentioned that it was it Catherine the Great who was the beginning of the popularization of caviar with the aristocracy, and that kind of spread throughout Western Europe. Give us a little bit of that sense, and sort of let's talk about other sort of cultural touchstones like that.
Sure. That's right. It was more or less a countryman's lunch, you know, something you might take to the fields and spread on bread just for a quick, you know, a quick dose of calories. But then Catherine the Great started serving it to European visitors in the 1600s, just as a, you know, here's a classic Russian dish that you should try.
Right.
And as Europeans became wealthier due to the Industrial Revolution, they started thinking, well, you know, this foreign food from Russia, it must be good. And
right.
So they started buying it, even, you know, sort of regardless whether they liked it or not. They just thought it was prestigious and fancy. And people went to enormous trouble to get caviar to Europe, figuring out how to put it on ice and barrels and ship it these long distances. You know, at the time that was very difficult, and it made caviar even more expensive, and therefore, I think people speculate, therefore made it even more popular because people thought, well, it's so expensive. You know, there must be something to all this furor about caviar.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, at the same time, you know, you mentioned that caviar is sort of the working man's lunch, just the way oysters were, you know, the working man's lunch here in New York. You know, I just actually did a show with somebody about oysters with Paul Greenberg, as a matter of fact, last week.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked
mm-hmm.
about his new book, American Catch. And you know, the Northeast and the West Coast, Northwest Coast, were both absolutely paved with oysters, and people ate them by the millions, and they cost a penny or half a penny a piece. And then somewhere along the line, I guess because they became harder to find and they were sort of off the air for a while, you could only get the only ones that were safe to eat were Canadian. Oysters suddenly became also a very luxurious treat for the aristocracy on both sides of the ocean. And I wondered if you wanted to hazard a guess about, you know, did caviar and oysters sort of get popular together for rich people, or was it just two completely separate things? But, you know, now you think of caviar, oysters, and foie gras as the three
yes.
sort of ultimate luxurious items. In fact, my friend Catherine Alford wrote a book. I think it's called Caviar, Oysters, and
it's called what?
I think there's a friend of mine who runs the Food Network Kitchen, and she wrote a book, which I believe is Caviar, Oysters, and Foie Gras. I think that's her cookbook. Yeah.
Right. And abalone is another one in there. And I think that, some anthropologist or psychologist could probably speculate on why all of these foods that are so expensive are also vaguely disgusting. You know, they're sort of vaguely
yes.
Forbidden and slimy and things you might
yes.
eat, might be, you know, might be dared to eat in another situation. They're somehow given, they somehow acquire this allure. So maybe it's the allure of the forbidden, the allure, or the theory that truly gourmet things are always on the edge of being spoiled or disgusting, and that's what makes them so good.
I guess.
I don't quite know what's going on there with just the taste and the texture appeal of it. Caviar is a slightly different story from oysters and, say, lobster, where they were disparaged and then they rose when they got rare, when they were fished out,
right.
they rose in popularity. Caviar rose in popularity before it became rare, and I think it was really just the lure of a foreign delicacy in Europe that gave it that stature at first.
I think that's probably
certainly
true.
It has become more expensive as it's gotten rarer, and I think that's only added to its cachet.
Absolutely. Well, the I'm not a big fan myself, and the thing that I always think of when I think about caviar is that incredibly funny scene in the movie Big with Tom Hanks. Do you remember that movie? Do you remember?
Yes.
He's like, and he's supposed to be a grown up, but he's really a little boy in a man's body, and he has a big bite of caviar. I mean, I literally wet my pants in the movie theater when I saw that, because that, frankly, was kind of more or less my response to it as well. But I've grown up a
little more. There's a certain Emperor's New Clothes phenomenon going on. I mean, I do believe what the chefs say, and, you know, that these are exotic tastes, and, you know, if you have a well-developed gourmet palate, that you appreciate them. But there's also a certain amount of, well, just like the Europeans in the 1600s and 1700s saying, well, it's, everybody likes this, and it's very expensive. It must be good.
Right, you know? Exactly.
Everybody eating shellfish or lobster, everybody eating oysters or lobster, and kind of looking at each other and going, well, okay, I guess this is what we eat now. I guess this is what is fancy.
Although I do love foie gras. But let's talk for a minute about sturgeon, just as a category of fish that has been so wildly overfished. We touched on that in the first half. But there are lots and lots of different subcategories besides paddlefish. There's white sturgeon, pallid sturgeon, Chinese sturgeon, American sturgeon. What's happening with all of those other breeds, and do they produce eggs that everyone wants to eat, or are some species better than others in terms of the kinds of eggs that they produce? And what's going to happen to them in the future? Are they returning? Are they resurgent? Is there farming? What kind of conservation?
Yeah, there are, there are many different sturgeon species. The IUCN, which is the International Union of Conservation for Nature, and that's an intergovernmental body that looks at species worldwide, considers sturgeon to be the most endangered family of animals anywhere on the planet. So none of them are doing well. Some are doing better than others. Some are better protected than others.
Mm-hmm.
The most sort of sought-after kind of caviar is the beluga caviar, which comes from the beluga sturgeon, and then the savruga caviar, which is another kind from the Caspian Sea. And those are both heavily, heavily restricted internationally. It's impossible to get those kinds of caviar in the U.S. now because they're so rare. And that has helped somewhat. As far as a viable commercial fishery for some of those species, it's not going to happen for generations, if ever. We do have some sturgeon species in the U.S. They are highly endangered. And there is, you know, a glimmer of hope as far as for caviar lovers. You know, these species are still very much in trouble in the wild, but there is a growing industry in sturgeon farming and farms caviar. So, and I've spoken to chefs who say, yes, you know, this caviar, these farming techniques have been refined until this caviar is basically indistinguishable from wild caviar. And people haven't gotten over the allure of wild caviar, but that's really just a psychological barrier. If you blind taste tested farmed caviar that's done right versus wild caviar, high grade wild caviar, you can tell the difference. And in some cases, you might think this farmed caviar is better.
Wow, amazing. And does caviar have I don't know if I should ask you this, because I mean, you're not a chef, but is that sense of miroir, you know, that everybody talks about with seafood and especially with oysters, does caviar have that same kind of, you know, each species or depending on where it comes from has an individual and specific taste, or is it? Is that
have its sense of place?
Yes,
apparently, and as you said, I'm not a chef, so I can't speak to that with authority. But apparently, it does. And one of the chefs I spoke to said, "Well, paddlefish caviar, you know, it kind of tastes like lake water, which is not really what you're going for. You know, that's not the exotic marine taste that people are looking for in caviar. So people who know caviar can tell that paddlefish caviar is not is not the top
not
grade.
Not as good, yeah.
Like I said, people who aren't familiar with it will be can be convinced otherwise.
I'm remembering that Iran at one time was a tremendous exporter of caviar. And
that's right.
What was their breed? Was that Osetra that they made? Because I remember
I believe so. They did a lot of fishing in the Caspian Sea.
Ah.
And at one point, there was a brief period not too long ago when Iranian caviar was available in the U.S. And it was, you know, it's very good. It's comparable to Russian caviar because it comes from the same place, from the Caspian Sea. But now it's no longer available.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the Caspian Sea is heavily polluted, if I'm not mistaken, isn't it?
So there's a lot of environmental problems in the Caspian Sea. So yeah. Overfishing is just one of the problems that sturgeon are facing, which is one reason why these fish have bounced back before, but it's not impossible that they will again, but they are facing a more complicated suite of problems than they were in the past.
And let's talk for a second about their spawning, because they swim upstream like salmon, and so damming up rivers, which we did with great abandon in the 50s and 60s in order to generate electricity and whatnot, that's had a big impact on sturgeon populations as well, hasn't it?
That's right. And in the Missouri River in particular, we dammed that, as you say, with abandon. And that has had a big effect on native sturgeon populations in the Missouri and on paddlefish. And the paddlefish population in Missouri that people were poaching from is actually supplemented by hatchery fish itself, because they have lost access to their natural spawning grounds. They will try and swim upstream and they'll run into a dam, and you can find them gathered at the dam trying to make their way upstream.
Yeah. Well, a couple of weeks ago, I had a guy on who was from the Natural Resources Defense Council, who's working on reintroducing salmon to the San Joaquin River. And he described, occasions where they are literally in places where the fish cannot make it upstream, either because the water level is so low or because there is a dam in the way. They will literally scoop up the fish and transport them to, higher up on the river so they can, continue to make their way up to their spawning grounds. I suppose, if people were as devoted to the idea of paddlefish as people are to the idea of salmon, we might do that. What do you think the environmental impact on losing a fish like paddlefish, a really big feeder, filter? Did you say they're a filter feeder?
Yeah, they are.
So what, are they like oysters? They clean the water?
Well, they eat invertebrates. And, just very small animals that live in the river. And people don't really know their place in the ecosystem. They may be, in some senses, a relict species where they are extremely old evolutionarily. People are always saying they're older than the dinosaurs, which is true. They've been around for that long. Yeah. It's hard to make a utilitarian argument as to, we need these fish to clean the water, we need these fish because they're an important part of the food chain. They may well be, but we don't know that. I think there's a moral argument to be made that something that's been around for so long, that's so big, such a grand part of the ecosystem, is not something that should be killed off for a luxury product.
Yeah, I would make that argument with you. I'd be right in the front lines on that one. I mean, I find I'm not going to get into that discussion with you, but it's just like the need to sort of eat something because I don't know why, it's really cool or whatever. I don't know. I don't get it. It's just not that great.
Well, I think we're always in search of the new,
As
a journalist, I'm always trying to put myself in other people's shoes. And I think the view from those shoes is that the new is irresistible and that the exotic is irresistible. And this happens to be something that for a combination of reasons we have chosen to chase to the ends of the earth, and the end of the earth is the Ozarks.
Yeah.
So
who knew?
Here we are. Yeah.
I always think of that as pink
country. And I'm sure Catherine the Great never would have predicted that, but here we are.
I'm sure she wouldn't have. Maybe we should wrap it up there, because that seems like a good spot. Can you want to promote? You have a website, you have Fern, you have other things that you're working on. Tell us what's going on. How do people find more out about you and about this article?
Well, I was supported in the reporting and writing of this article by FERN, which is the Food and Environment Reporting Network, and they are at thefern.org. And also, the story was published by our publishing partner, medium.com, and that's just medium.com. You can find it there. You can search for the article there. It's called Caviar's Last Stand. And then my website is michellenyhouse.com, and I have a funny last name. It's spelled N-I-J-H-U-I-S, so michellenyhouse.com.
Cool. Thanks. You're Dutch. Is that a
Dutch
name?
Yeah. I don't speak it, but I am Dutch.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I really enjoyed this piece. I thought it was great. And certainly this is a really fun interview. Definitely off my beaten track for sure. I hope people enjoyed it as well. So I will be going to Australia in a couple of days, actually, at the end of this week. So we'll be running a couple of reruns, I suppose. But I'll be reporting on the cattle industry there for Food Arts Magazine. I'm going to take a junket with a bunch of chefs, and I'll be visiting a lot of packing plants and cattle ranches and sheep ranches, among other things. So I'll have plenty to say about that. I'm hoping to put together a few programs on that subject. And then the other thing I wanted to just mention to my regular listeners, and that is that we'll be following up in a few weeks on a couple of new developments that have just caught my eye. Many of you know that I've been on top of this story called about poultry inspection. It's now called the New Poultry Inspection System, which was formerly known as HIMP, which was an acronym that was part of the Hazard Analysis and Critical Control Point HACCP program, which has been around for quite a while. Anyway, this unfortunate new development in the poultry industry, which will eventually be adopted by other industries in the livestock sector, is the one in which the FDA inspector or the USDA inspectors have been taken off of the production lines in broiler factories and poultry processing plants and put at the end of the line where they will swab possibly 10 birds an hour for disease. Meanwhile, they're processing 140 birds per minute. The only silver lining to this particular cloud in our food safety horizon is that they didn't speed up the chain speed to 175, which was what the original legislation called for. But the HIMP model has now been passed into action. Poultry companies can opt in or out. You can be sure that they will be opting in droves because essentially the fox is now guarding the hen house. Just be aware of that when you're buying and cooking chickens. And then the other thing that caught my eye and which I got a press release from the Natural Resources Defense Council about is another story that I've covered a lot, and that is antibiotics in our food chain, specifically in livestock. And the NRDC had brought a suit against the FDA for failing to protect us, essentially, from what have been dubbed in the media superbugs. They're not really superbugs, but they are multi-drug resistant pathogens brought about by the excessive use of antibiotics in the food chain. And the NRDC has now lost this case in court, which is a great blow to them. They've been working on this case for several years. In the next few weeks, when I get back from Australia, I will definitely be bringing on somebody from NRDC to talk about this. They are still in the process of sorting out what their appeal is going to be, et cetera. Otherwise, we would have been talking about it today instead of our wonderful interview with Michelle Nyhaus about paddlefish, which I totally enjoyed. So thanks for listening. I'll be back in a few weeks, hopefully with some really interesting new material. And thanks to my sponsor, Kane Winery, and to my engineer, Jack Inslee, always. And I'll see you in a few weeks. Enjoy the rest of August. Take care, folks. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.